I won't tell you what Representative Bellamy called it on the floor the other day. We're going to proceed with lights off and try and keep it as cool as possible in here. This committee has floor session at 3:30. I anticipate that if we can get the speakers okay to be excused, we're working on getting one of the big rooms in the new wing for after our break, for those of you. So with that, I'm going to go a little out of order and begin with the public hearing on House Bill 2643. There's still a sign-up sheet out there, but I understand there are people here that wish to testify on 2643, which changes the provisions of the Residential Landlord and Tenant Act. Are there witnesses? You needn't sign up. Come up and introduce yourself.
Do you have a copy?
I do have a copy.
Please go ahead. For those that have not yet signed up on this bill, there is a yellow sign-up sheet on the desk over there.
My name is Mary Stogsdale. I'm from Eugene, Oregon, and I'm here as a guest of the ARHA Affiliated Rental Housing Association and the Rental Owners Association of Lane County. I'm a consultant, and I specialize in the rental housing industry, and as part of our service to the community, we provide a hotline service which aids both owners and renters of tenants of rental property in the Eugene area, and they're referred to us by the Eugene Police Department and by the clerk, the court clerks, and from many other sources, Chamber of Commerce, etc. And so we are aware of the problems that are faced by both the owners and the tenants in rental property. I would like to refer to only two sections of this to be very brief, and I will refer by page number to make it easy for you if you wish to follow. On page 4, section 9, the proposed amendment, subsection 3, this amendment is of great importance to landlords. A 24-hour notice for harm or damage is issued only in extreme cases, is not one that's used lightly by the landlords and is not taken lightly by the courts. Requires a great deal of proof, and it generally requires great danger to the tenants, other tenants in the property, management personnel, guests of tenants, or extreme property damage. We ask that this provision be implemented into law in order to protect those who are subjected to danger. On page number 6, section 13, the most frequent problem faced by rental owners is that of evictions. And the most common reason for eviction is unpaid rent. There is some confusion in the counting of the days as laid out in the statute, saying that it must be in excess of 7 days, and some courts will not accept the 7 days until the eighth day. Others have refused to accept it except based on judicial days, which is not what the statute says. And I think that the purpose of this is a clarification of the statute, and we certainly support the wording in that, of the clarification in that statute. Our organization has reviewed the bill, and we fully support it, and we ask that you pass it as written. Rental Owners Association of Lane County wishes to support 2643 in its entirety. Thank you. May I answer any questions for you?
Other questions of Mary? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
I have a letter from the Department of Commerce. Virginia, does everybody on the committee have that? Or is it
yes.
Just,
yes.
Is there somebody here from the Department of Commerce to speak?
Chairperson Hanlon, members of the subcommittee, my name is Steve Hawes. I'm Deputy Real Estate Commissioner. The letter you have is from Morella Larson, the Real Estate Commissioner. As most of you know, the Real Estate Division in handling its real estate license law, licenses and regulates, real estate licensees who are engaged in property management for owners for a fee. Our letter addresses only one section of the bill, Section 11, which amends ORS 91760. If you'll note on page 6 of the bill, lines 9 through 11, a new subsection 11 would be added to the provision dealing primarily with security deposits, refundable deposits, non-refundable deposits, and so forth. The real estate division, based on this rule, has in the past adopted two rules, one in property management generally, and Oregon Administrative Rules 863-10042 sub 5, dealing with the handling of refundable security deposits by property managers, and OAR 863-10026 sub 3, dealing with the handling of refundable security deposits by property managers when they place those or want to place those in an interest-bearing account. The amendment in Section 11 of the bill on page 6 would simply eliminate, it does two things, one I think intended, one I assume unintended. First thing it does is remove compliance with all the provisions of ORS 241, which is the general client's trust accounting requirements for all real estate licensees, and all the rules applying to client's trust accounting, from those residential property managers who, through their owners, hold a security deposit not exceeding $200 per dwelling unit. Now, that apparently is the intended goal, to remove trust accounting requirements. However, secondly, the way it's drafted, we feel that it also removes all clients' trust accounting requirements for the property managers in those cases. So it would not be dealing directly with the question of clients' trust accounting first, specifically with the question of what you do if you have an interest-bearing account that you want to use for deposit. I might tell you the nub of the discussion, I guess, the nub of the reason this amendment's in there, based on our prior contact with property managers in the state, is that they object to having the tenant in a residential situation approve placing those refundable tenants' deposits in a interest-bearing client's trust account. They feel that the tenant should not be involved in approving placement in that interest-bearing account, nor, as the statute says, in approving the real estate broker's ability to earn interest on that account, in effect keeping that interest as part of the management fee. So the nub apparently is that although our rules are there because the tenant retains an interest in the funds until those funds are actually accounted for or returned within 30 days after termination of the tenancy, it appears that some of the property managers would prefer that the tenant have no say in either the deposit, use of interest from, or placement of the refundable tenant's deposits. So we oppose the amendment by Section 11, since it is the only amendment to 91760 in Section 11. We would also ask that that be deleted from the bill, if it's your pleasure to move on other portions of the bill.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Is there anybody here to testify in the public hearing of this bill that's from out of town? Well, I guess we just keep it local. Mr. Irvine. I didn't mean to say all the interests represented were local.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jim Irvin on behalf of the Oregon State Home Builders Association, the Oregon Multifamily Housing Council. We are prepared to support the bill and support the amendments to the bill. The small problem, there were some further negotiations on this bill late last night with the legal aid, Mike Marcus and I, and have been spending some time going through the provisions of this bill along with Ed Leek of Representative Springer's office. And traditionally, this bill, or the way that the Oregon State Home Builders and the Multifamily Housing Council have worked, is to work in concert with the legal aid organization and present a bill with closure on at least those two parties.
Excuse me, Jim.
Yes.
Maybe I'm missing something because I've got my file here and looked through our stack today. You're speaking to amendments.
Yes. There are. You do not have a copy?
We don't.
There should be amendments there. Dash 1, 263-1.
Well, we've got one out of three reps that have copies of the amendment, so we ought to all have them here. Well, great.
Mr. Chairman.
Dash 1.
Yes.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. I mean, not only referring to that, but I'm referring to others that you do not have in your hand right now. That is the reason why I'm here with my hat in my hand, so to speak. Sue Hanna of Legislative Council has those. She is completing them at this moment. Mike Marcus of Legal Aid is with Sue Hanna. And for Mike's and my presentation, if possible, we would like to request that we have a few more minutes to be able to get that together before we bring those to you. Sue Hanna is immediately working on those right now to have them completed. If you want me to speak to them, I think I can, but I would prefer to do that with Mike Marcus because that's the way we have done in the past.
Okay. Are there others here to testify on this bill?
Again, I apologize, Mr. Chairman, but
We'll close the public hearing. Representative Bellamy.
Maybe I could ask.
Okay, I won't close it yet.
I'd like to ask you to comment on the Department of Commerce's concerns.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bellamy, Jim Irvin again. Our concern is that traditionally what happens in real estate management companies' offices is that they go through an accounting of security deposits, and owners quite regularly choose to use the security deposits to assist in cash flow. We want to make sure that that is clearly on the record, that is understood, and we're not trying to hide anything in terms of that. That is not the property manager. And what happens in the market where a real estate licensee is not acting as the fiduciary for both the tenant and the owner, the owners traditionally take the security deposits, deposit those monies into the operating account of the apartment complex.
Yeah.
Since that is typically the practice, what happens with a professional property management company, if a property is transferred from an owner to a professional property management company, it changes the method in which that owner is typically doing business. We put the cap of $200 on that so that because we believe that in fact that is not an amount that is going to create there's a great deal of risk to anybody. The security of the apartment complex itself is there to protect the tenants. The landlord-tenant law specifically states that within 30 days of a termination of tenancy that the deposit shall be refunded, or in fact that the landlord is subject to double damages. So there is a great incentive on the part to in fact make sure that security deposits are refunded in an expeditious and timely manner. On the other hand, having to segregate them, and there may be some units that have them, it takes a great deal of staff accounting time on the part of the property manager to go ahead and segregate those accounts out. And although they do segregate the owner's account specifically, and we don't have any problem keeping record of them, they should keep separate record that those accounts are in fact there. But if there was, for instance, as a good example, $5,000 in the account and the security deposits were $1,000, and there was a mortgage check that was written for $4,100, you would be in violation of the property manager, if he made that mortgage check, would be in violation of the real estate law. We think that that is making the real estate rules. We think that that is putting the property manager under a great burden. So we're not objecting to the accounting. We're not objecting to making sure that the tenant's monies are returned to them in a timely manner, according to the landlord-tenant law. The particular problem is administrative to property management companies. And in essence, what happens is that property management companies don't allow deposits, and they go to fees, non-refundable fees. And that is not a benefit to the tenant, because if a tenant is a good tenant, keeps the apartment clean, terminates their tenancy, and the apartment is left clean, it is our feeling that that tenant ought to be run. It should be encouraged to keep the apartment clean and maintain the property, and should have the opportunity to receive a deposit back. But without that opportunity in the rule, property management companies will merely charge fees and not allow tenants to even pay a deposit because of the administrative problem that they
run into. Why don't you continue on with the dash one and tell us where we're at. Perhaps Mr. Marcus will be here by the time you finish.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, who
yes.
are the dash one amendments?
What representative's amendments are the dash one amendments?
They are Representative Springer's amendments. All the amendments that are coming are Representative Springer's. They are supported by the Multifamily Housing Council, and they are supported by legal aid, as Mike will testify when he... There are some technical...
Dash one, then, represents your basic agreement with a few little fine points that you were at late last night, right?
That is correct.
Is that a fair characterization?
That's a fair characterization.
Then why don't you get started with the bulk of it?
May I pick up a copy?
Mr. Marcus will...
Since Mike has my copy, you ran down to Sue Hannah's with. I'm sorry. I don't want to slow up this hearing.
Go ahead. I believe there are some over there.
But there is a substantive amendment which Mr. Hawes may wish to comment to that is coming up in the Dash 2 amendments, and maybe I'll address that first. So he might want to comment about that before, if he has to leave on some other business. That amendment basically directs the Real Estate Division to issue a special license for property management, to be called a property management, a real estate property manager. That amendment allows the Real Estate Division to establish criteria, requirements, and examinations for an individual to receive that license. The purpose of that amendment is that in our industry, in the housing industry, there are many builders that build residential apartments and then subsequently sell them. And when they...
Marcus?
Oh, here he is.
Why don't you come on and write up?
Going through without the... She's going to get them right here.
Well,
she can, yeah. I'm speaking to the real estate property management portion of it now. That the developer builds a unit, retains it for a period of time, and then subsequently sells it. If he retains ownership in the property, he is not subject to the real estate law and does not have to be a real estate licensee to manage that property. However, if he should sell the rental unit, then he must be a real estate licensee to continue managing the property. Regularly, especially in the rural communities of Oregon, where builders have sold apartment complexes after they've held them for a period of time, they are requested to continue managing. Problem is, they may not be real estate brokers, and in fact they're operating outside the law. This is a dilemma not only for the owner who may be an absentee owner, but it's a dilemma for the developer who may have sold the apartment project on contract. And because of his fine management in the past, and the confidence of the owner, of the new purchaser, now wishes to continue managing the property. This bill, this amendment, merely allows the real estate division to issue a specialty license for that purpose. The concept of specialty licenses is not new to the Department of Commerce. We have them in the plumbing division, in the electrical division, and we have them in the real estate division. In fact, they have a specialty license for appraisers already. So we don't believe that's a new concept, and obviously Mr. Haas would like to, I'm sure, review the amendments to see, make sure they're in order. This was just, again, this was something that was put together in the last few hours. So that's the reason why we don't have those amendments completely drafted. They are in close form to what was in House Bill 2748. They were very similar to that, except the House Bill 2748 dealt with real estate mortgage brokers as well as property managers, and they suggested that the real estate division develop a special real estate broker's license, and the amendments, as you will see, suggest that they only have a real estate property manager's license. And so that's a substantive real estate change. In terms of the balance of the amendments, I think probably what would be easier is that we take it through, we go through the bill section by section and just review the changes that we have made. And maybe, if you don't mind, that we should speak to our now dash two amendments, which are down with Sue Hanna. Is that the easiest for your convenience? Is that the easiest way to do that? Why don't we both do this together, Mike? And you want to go ahead and start out?
All right. For Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Michael Marcus, Legal Aid in Portland, and Mr. Irvine and myself have discussed this matter ad nauseum, and I'm afraid we're not through, but I think we've reached closure on this as far as we're concerned. I have asked that two hand-engrossed versions be distributed to you. House Bill 2643 with LC amendments of 42787 incorporates the first batch of amendments, which are dash one, which LC prepared basically for my draft, plus the new section 15, which deals with garbage collection. The second hand engrossed version, which has at its upper right the notation showing supplemental amendments only 5787, incorporate the supplemental amendments, all of which are with Sue Hanna right now, and she's working on the complete LC draft. If I may just go through House Bill 2643 with LC amendments, that's the first hand engrossed version. I'll point out where the supplemental amendments come in. And I think rather than start with the bill as it was originally drafted, I suspect you wish me only to address what the bill as it would be with the amendments and point those out to you, I assume.
If you would. Assuming that represents your interest.
Well, it does, and I think that it would be a waste of time to go through a lot of the bill that we've agreed should be out. Section 1 was originally designed to deal with the problem of a property owner being stuck with a claim against a tenant simply because the property owner shares a common property manager with the tenant, even though the property in which the tenant resided was not in any other way connected to that owner. Since that time, in the supplemental amendments, and this is probably the major portion of the supplemental amendments, the parties have gone back and forth because, as you see from the supplemental amendment engrossed version of Section 1 of the bill, that section has been expanded considerably. What it ends up doing in its present state is to do three things, really. One is to prohibit any supplier of a utility service, and this would include public utility commissioner covered utilities as well as municipalities, from transferring a claim which is against a tenant to the owner unless the owner has consented in writing. And the reason for that is essentially aimed at single-family residences where it's typical for the tenant to get the utility in their own name. There's nothing in the Landlord-Tenant Act in its present form which requires the landlord to provide the utility service. The garbage portion of this bill, literally garbage, not figuratively, would be an exception to that. The second subsection would make it clear that a supplier of utility services which would otherwise have the power to impose a lien as a means of collecting unpaid utility bills cannot have a lien against real property with respect to services rendered or delivered to a tenant unless the owner has consented in writing to that arrangement. This would mean in the typical multifamily situation or a multimeter situation or in any situation where the landlord elects to be responsible for water service, for example, the utility would certainly be free to require as a condition of allowing the landlord to open that account a consent to a lien and other, the owner's responsibility, whether it's a private utility or a utility which is capable of imposing a lien through the tax assessing procedures. What this would do is prevent a lien from being imposed in a single-family residence situation or other single-meter situation where the landlord has not had the service in the landlord's name. Now, the risk of that in some places may be to make utilities or municipal utilities, water and sewer, to want to extract deposits from tenants as a means of ensuring their financial security. Our concern is that with very low-income and low-income tenants, tenants might end up having spent all of their available cash to move into a place, perhaps a welfare check, and then find that they can't turn on the water because the water company or the city of Portland, whatever it is, requires a deposit. So the trade-off here is that a supplier of utility service which is not covered by PUC would not be able to extract a lien as a deposit as a condition of opening an account for a person whose household income is below 80% of the median income. Presumably, if there is a problem, it would be absorbed in the rest of the rate base, and perhaps the rest of us would have to pay increased deposits or deposits where we don't now have to. Moving on to Section 3 of the bill, in its original form, Section 3 would simply permit, make it clear that a landlord who, let me back up a minute, there are exclusions from the Residential Landlord-Tenant Act. This it concerns one which is of repeated concern to property managers, and that is when you have a resident manager whose right to occupy the premises is conditioned upon employment in and about the premises. The Landlord-Tenant Act excludes that person from the scope of the Landlord-Tenant Act. There is considerable confusion as to whether an eviction action is necessary to evict that person, or even whether it's available to evict that person. In its original form, this Section 3 of the bill would permit a landlord to use the FED process to remove a resident manager who would otherwise be excluded from the act. The engrossed version, which is on page 2 of the showing supplemental amendments version of the Handy Rose version of the bill, shows the current agreement. The trade-off here was the original version would have permitted eviction on 72 hours notice or the period provided by the the employment agreement. The trade-off is to drop that to 24 hours but make it clear that an FED is required. Everybody felt that certainty was necessary and to be achieved here. It would be under this provision clear that you have to use an FED to get rid of, if you will, a resident manager. On the other hand, you only require 24 hours notice. We added a section, a sentence which would make it clear that this section does not create the relationship of landlord and tenant between the landlord and such an employee. That is of concern to landlord employers, understandably. Of course, it doesn't affect, if there already is the relationship of landlord and tenant between the two, apart from the employment arrangement, this would not destroy it either. This simply doesn't create that relationship. Section 4 of the bill, going back to the bigger hand and gross version, merely takes all notices which are to be served under the Residential Landlord and Tenant Act and says that they can be served personally or by mail. It retains the present special provisions for non-payment of rent notice, There are some mobile home notices which I outline in my written testimony, such as the rent increase notice and the notice which a tenants association can send to demand a meeting about a rent increase, that are simply not covered by the existing law as to how you serve a notice. This would make it clear that you can mail any notice under the Landlord-Tenant Act. This isn't summons and complaint, but these are the notices that landlords and tenants might serve or send to each other, or you can serve them personally. That's the only change that would result from the amended version of Section 4. Section 5 would make it clear that for those notices which are specified in terms of periods of days, not those which involve hours, this is a 24-hour notice, this is a 74-hour, 72-hour notice, but most notices under the Act are specified, prescribed in terms of days. This provision would merely make it clear that the days are to be calculated by calendar days. There have been some judges who have read days as meaning judicial days, which was never intended. This is merely clarification. Section 7 is probably the most complicated or esoteric version a portion of the bill, which requires, unfortunately, little background. There is, under the landlord